Bitcoin has failed before, and then it gets fixed because it's open source. In the worst case scenario, I still don't think Bitcoin's dead. I think that lots of people learn a tough lesson about how disgusting the internet is, and we fix the software.
Are people really going to risk 20 years in prison or whatever on a public ledger? Like, is that going to grow to be such a problem that it's really an attack vector for regulators or government? It only takes one, I suppose.
I don't think the governance over Knots is inherently better than the governance over Bitcoin Core.
You've got BlackRock in the game. They've got skin in the game now. You've got Fidelity. You've got all these big institutions.
Overnight, the Treasury Department of the United States could actually put the whole Bitcoin network on an OFAC sanctions list, and every U.S. person and related entity is banned from using Bitcoin.
Hey everyone, Michael here with the Bitcoin Way podcast. Today on the show, I have OG Pierre Richard on. We talk about Knots versus Core basically the entire time. Very interesting discussion. He sort of hates on both sides and appreciates the different benefits that he sees them bring. If you're trying to sort through this, I think this will be a very beneficial episode for you. Hey everyone, like I said in the intro, I've got Pierre here with me. Pierre, welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to this conversation. So I want to start at the most basic level. We have had this Core versus Knots debate. Twitter X is absolutely heated. Everyone's yelling at each other, calling each other all sorts of ridiculous names. I think probably you would be a very helpful person to have explain at the most basic level, what is the change being pushed into Core 30 that so many opponents are frustrated about? And could you maybe to the best of your ability articulate for a Core 30 proponent what it is that they're trying to accomplish with those changes?
Yeah, okay. So I think that's a good place to start. So one is that they are changing the default for a mempool policy. And what this policy says is that if your transaction has an output in it with an op return script operation with a size greater than, I think that historically it's been 40, it's been 80, and then some argue it should be 110 or 120. But Bitcoin Core developers have decided to release version 30 with basically no limit. It's from a mempool policy perspective, but the limit from a consensus rules perspective remains in place, which I think is 100,000 bytes, if I remember correctly. And so it's a massive increase compared to where the mempool policy was. The mempool policy is really what do Bitcoin nodes relay in terms of new transactions that are in the backlog to get into the next block. And the argument from the Core perspective for why it makes sense, why this change makes sense at all, is that the goal is to have the policies for the mempool to be as close to the consensus rules for what could end up in a block. Because any kinds of differences between those two sets, the block controls, meaning that if there's a transaction that is in a block that is not in your mempool, your node will actually verify that transaction and, if it's valid, allow it to be included in the block, even though it was not in your mempool at that point. And so from the developer's perspective, who are really focused on minimizing latency for the network and really maximizing the effectiveness of fee estimation, which depends on the backlog of transactions, and that has to be predictive of what will be in the next block in order to be accurate. And so that's where, from first principles, they argue that it's really important for those two things, those two sets, to be as closely overlapped as possible, consensus rules and mempool policy. So I think that the challenge here is that there's a lot of contention over, what I would argue would be that can be true, and the direction should be in the opposite way, that consensus rules get closer to mempool policy. Personally, I would go even further and argue that there should be a soft fork to remove op return entirely. Now, for a whole host of reasons, my position does not have sufficient support to get a soft fork through. You would need, I would argue you would need really, 95% rough consensus to get what I'm asking for. And so then in my mind, the question is, in the absence of that rough consensus, what is the power that mempool operators have relative to consensus rules? I think that the knots camp is that if you get enough nodes running knots, and well, let's say all the nodes ran knots, then the miners would actually be really limited in their ability to include op returns, large op returns, right? Because I don't believe knots lowers the default to zero.
I think it's like 40. I think it's 40.
So it would make it such that if you wanted to have a transaction that has more than 40 bytes in it, you would have to go directly to the mining pool and they would have to look at it and approve it. And so I think the argument from the knots perspective is that that would add sufficient friction to the propagation of spam that you would end up with less spam in blocks. It wouldn't be perfect because you could still have, some jerks persuade a mining pool to include 100,000 byte op return in there. That's why it's important to have nodes that are filtering out those transactions, is to add friction and to marginally decrease kind of the amount of op returns. Then the response from the core side, right, from playing this out, and hopefully I'm steel manning both sides here, and we'll try to get to a synthesis at some point, is that really the problem is that when you look at the amount of spam that has been going into blocks, it hasn't really been coming from op returns. It's been coming from inscriptions that are inputs to taproot outputs, and that accidentally, and this is really getting into the controversy, there's not as restrictive policies on mempool policies on the size of taproot inputs than there have been on past input types. And so the developers argue that that's okay, because actually if we added restrictions there, then it could close off future interesting monetary uses of taproot inputs that they don't want to close off. They don't want to close that door just to fight spam. And so the current mempool, V29 of Bitcoin Core does actually relay these inscriptions. And the knots perspective is, yeah, okay, well, that's a bug and that needs to be fixed. That's not a potential feature in the future that is very hypothetical at this point. And furthermore, if the Bitcoin Core developers turn out to be correct, that, it actually is useful to have large taproot inputs, then you could modify the mempool policy to take that into account. Because mempool policy is far more malleable than consensus rules. You can change them kind of willy-nilly, as Knots has proven. And also there's another implementation, Knobs with a B, that is optimized for like just being able to configure everything about your node. I don't know if that provides a helpful overview. I think fundamentally the challenge here is that you have to wonder, when there is a consensus change that doesn't have consensus, to what extent can mempool policy patch things up? Peter Todd has gone in the opposite direction with his software Libra Relay, which basically says our mempool policy is to not have a mempool policy. And, you know, anything that's within consensus rules is fine, which means that anybody who wants to spam with OpReturn could go use Libra Relay and be able to funnel spam into mining pool blocks. So, happy to hear your thoughts or questions or where we can go with this.
So to what extent do you think the core's patch in removing OpReturn could actually benefit preventing spam in terms of like these out of band transactions? Like, I don't know how much friction filters create to prevent, you know, people from going directly to the miners and bypassing, you know, the network of nodes. Is that reasonable for them to assume or to imagine, or is it already happening to a significant degree?
Well, I don't think it is already happening because of preferential peering, where the mining pools want to connect to nodes that match up with their own policies, and so they wouldn't necessarily connect to NOTS nodes. And so really, you know, you'd have to get to a very large market share. I've heard different numbers thrown around from like 80% to 99% to 100% in order to effectively surround the mining pools with nodes that only relay small OpReturns. And that absent that, you might say like, oh, well, 30% of the hash rate is a great win in the sense that means that we get 30% less spam, and that, you know, you're not necessarily trying to aim for perfection here. We're really just trying to mitigate the impact of spam and make room for monetary transactions that want to pay a low fee. So ultimately, in order to be 100% successful, NOTS would have to have 100% market share. And that at that point, it's like, why not do a soft fork, right? If you have 100% market share.
So describe for me, why would your, I know this isn't like a formal proposal that you've made, or at least I don't think it is, a soft fork. Describe for me why, if everyone agrees, we want less, because this is where I'm a little bit skeptical, because yeah. I'm a philosophical NOTS supporter, not a technical NOTS supporter, I would say. If everyone agrees we don't want spam on the network, we're just trying to make it less harmful and put it, you know, have an OpReturn versus, then why wouldn't a soft fork? If everyone was being honest about that, why wouldn't a soft fork be palatable for 95% of users?
It would be. I mean, I think people have good faith misunderstandings about the value of OpReturn and of, honestly, scripting programmability in Bitcoin in general. And this really goes back to the debate about, like, where does Bitcoin's value come from? And there has always been within Bitcoin a view about the utility, right? It's about the utility of the cryptography and of all of this, that, you know, you can make smart contracts. A lot of those people left to start Ethereum because they couldn't get the OpReturn increase at the time. And then the debate was about, oh, well, it's the utility of payments, right? So that's why we need to have big blocks. And then a lot of those people left with the block size war and they went to Bitcoin Cash. It's now a question of with the current user base, do we have enough people who entirely reject the utility argument such that we get to, you know, that consensus on a soft fork? And I don't think that's the case. When I look at the community, when I look at the holders of Bitcoin, in fact, I'd argue the holders of Bitcoin themselves are the worst for this, because so many altcoiners hold 80% Bitcoin, right? And so they believe in like the utility thesis more than anyone else. So, and then the miners as well. I don't think we have consensus there, and the developers either, right? So, while there is an echo chamber on Twitter and on podcasts that correctly understands where Bitcoin's value comes from, I don't think it's widespread enough to be able to have a soft fork that decisively says that. It's also because there's a high bar for that kind of soft fork, where in Bitcoin, generally, what we try to accomplish from a technical perspective is forward and backward compatibility. And breaking that kind of compatibility, I think, should have a high bar to it. And so I think that removing OpRetuRn crosses that high bar for me personally. But I understand that given that other people have misguided views about utility, it doesn't cross that high bar. And so that's where, you know, you kind of have to have a level of self-awareness of, even though I'm an advocate for this soft fork, I realize that the reasoning for it is sufficiently advanced that I can't expect everyone to agree with me. All I can do is continue to, you know, speak the truth on it, educate folks about it. But I think what's not constructive would be to go out there and say, if I don't get my way, Bitcoin is going to fail, right? That Bitcoin's going to collapse. This will destroy Bitcoin. I think that those are really irresponsible statements, and that I am comfortable stating that if I don't get my way, I think Bitcoin will continue to succeed despite the spam, despite, you know, the higher cost of running a Bitcoin node, despite the higher transaction fees. I think Bitcoin will continue to succeed. It's a shame that we have spammers to begin with. It's a shame that we don't have consensus on how to make their lives as hard as possible. But Bitcoin is going to continue to succeed.
Yeah, I would say that's where I sometimes part ways with the Knots camp. Is I've grown to believe that this is not like an existential threat. And in talking with some people who are not necessarily pro core, but very frustrated with the Knots side. You know, like the whole CSAM debate, like, is this going to be, are we going to be, you know, just blasted with illegal content, you know, images on the blockchain? Is are people really going to risk 20 years in prison or whatever on a public ledger? Is that going to grow to be such a problem that it's really an attack vector for regulators or government? It only takes one, I suppose, you know, it takes one turd in the pool kind of thing to, you know, to dirty it. But I can appreciate that it's overblown. And I saw Mechanic, who I generally go on.
Let's say it's not overblown. Let's say that V30 comes out. The worst happens. You know, there's a press conference with Attorney General Pam Bondi, and she says, you know, we're going to prosecute any Bitcoin node operators that are, you know, relaying this information, whether it's in a block or in a transaction. And the Bitcoin price tanks, you know, to like $1,000 or $100 or whatever it is. I think that that would actually cause there to be a 99.9% consensus that we need an immediate soft fork that stops all OpRetuRns and literally removes the data, the offending data in a historical block, and says, you know, a valid Bitcoin node should not download that OpRetuRn. And, you know, it's just hard coded in there. And, everybody apologizes to Luke, and we continue. You know, like, Bitcoin has failed before. So, and then it gets fixed because it's open source. And so I think that the anti-fragility here, like, we can't ignore that. In the worst case scenario, I still don't think Bitcoin's dead. I think that lots of people learn a tough lesson about how disgusting the internet is, and we fix the software.
I think that's sort of where my head's at. It's to the point that you made about like mempool policy being malleable. And I think that the beauty of software is that it's malleable in general. And so in an emergency situation, I think you're right. Like everyone says, okay, Luke was right. And I don't know if that's actually the case. And I'm not convinced necessarily it's going to be the case.
I think that, Price really, especially if it was a violent, you know, not literally violent, but figuratively violent price movement and a very, you know, tense moment that, everybody sobers up a little bit. Right. And they take off their, silly wizard's costume and, they kind of start thinking a little more rationally.
Yeah. So what would you put the odds of an event, maybe not quite as drastic as Pam Bondi coming on, you know, Fox News or something?
Yeah, less than 1%, because today there are ways of putting bad images onto the Bitcoin blockchain. And to my knowledge, nothing illegal has been put up there that has resulted in increased legal risk for Bitcoin node operators. And so I really don't put a whole lot of credence on the idea that OpRetuRN is such a dramatic easing of being able to put bad information on it. And that, look, I think that there's a lot of very sophisticated internet trolls out there who, whether it's because they're operating a competing blockchain or because they work for Elizabeth Warren, you know, that they would do a false flag attack on Bitcoin today or, you know, 2 years ago when ordinals and inscriptions came out. That they could have uploaded, you know, anything. And I think that one of the reasons what stops people from doing this is that it's very hard to kind of make sure that you cleaned up your trail, right? And that it's not going to get traced back to you. And so, you know, if you're trolling and you're putting bad data on the blockchain and the FBI, like, pulls on some threads, finds some IP addresses, searches your hard drive, searches the cache, you know, all these forensic analysis that they're experts at, right? They're like world experts at finding these disgusting people and, metaphorically throwing them into the wood chipper. I think it'd be a horrible idea to destroy your life just because you thought it would be a fun troll to upload this to the blockchain.
Yeah. No, I tend to agree. At the same time, I see that at some point that could happen, and I would be some crazy person might try to do it. They have nothing to lose, or just, you know, don't care. They think they're smart enough. And I would be curious. I'm not curious. I don't want to find out, but I would be curious how that would play out, in terms of attention from government. I would have to imagine, though, that you've got BlackRock in the game. They've got skin in the game now. You've got Fidelity. You've got all these big institutions. To what extent are they willing to make Larry Fink look like an idiot for getting into Bitcoin because of one bad actor's, you know, decision to do something like that? It feels like it would be handled more delicately than we're coming after node operators, at least in the short term.
Sure. Yeah. I think that that more delicate approach has been tried for a very long time of essentially creating reputational damage around Bitcoin and saying, you know, drug dealers, ransomware, foreign adversaries, North Korea hacking, OFAC sanctioned transactions, there are very stiff criminal and civil penalties for, these illegal images. There are also very harsh penalties for facilitating OFAC transactions. And it's an area of law that is actually kind of open to interpretation in a gray area where overnight, the Treasury Department of the United States could actually put the whole Bitcoin network on an OFAC sanctions list and overnight say everybody's banned. Every U.S. person and related entity is banned from using Bitcoin. They have that red button on their desk and they've had it since Bitcoin, since 2009. Right. And, you know, there's lots of, you could ask yourself, like, why have they not pushed that button? One is that they don't see Bitcoin as an existential threat. The other is, you know, they might actually see it as an opportunity. So lots of different motivations for why they wouldn't push that button. But you also have to look at, and I recently did this analysis. I scanned the whole blockchain for all of the OFAC sanctioned addresses to see kind of the prevalence there. If you did that, you would notice that there are US-based, US-regulated Bitcoin mining pools that include transactions that are either spending from or to OFAC sanctioned addresses. And that under some different interpretations of current existing regulations, what they're doing is really open to criminal liability today. And so, you know, you could argue that what they should do is leave those transactions in the mempool and let foreign mining pools include those in blocks. And then, you know, building on top of a block that has an OFAC sanctioned address is very different than earning a transaction fee from it and voluntarily including it in your own block, right? If you think about kind of the degree of involvement where, because if the US government said you can't build on top of a block that has an OFAC sanctioned transaction, then they would effectively be banning Bitcoin mining in the United States because probabilistically you have to do that. But as a practical matter, the US government could ask US mining pools to voluntarily, or, you know, by law, to mandatory, to not include transactions that are OFAC sanctioned and to allow those transactions to be included in foreign blocks. The reason why they don't do that, I think, is twofold. One, in a way, they would be telling, let's say, a US mining pool to give that transaction fee to an Iranian miner, which would also be sending funds to a sanctioned entity. So yeah, they kind of have an obligation to take that fee for themselves, right? And to prevent a foreign adversary from benefiting from that transaction, you know, which is kind of paradoxical. The other is that when the US government thinks about OFAC addresses, really what they're talking about is the fiat on and off ramps that are FinCEN regulated. And what they want to accomplish is when somebody sends Bitcoin from a sanctioned address to a regulated exchange or broker, that regulated exchange or broker freezes those Bitcoin on the platform and notifies law enforcement so that law enforcement can seize those Bitcoin, right? And so if a Bitcoin miner, if let's say all the Bitcoin miners censored those transactions, the Bitcoin would never reach the regulated entity. And so the government would never have the opportunity to actually seize the Bitcoin, right? Because you're basically saying all sanctioned Bitcoin have to remain in self-custody outside of the US's ability to seize them, which would also be very paradoxical. And so I think that the relationship between Bitcoin and regulators and law enforcement is far more it's far more nuanced than just saying, if somebody does something illegal on the Bitcoin blockchain, then unbounded criminal liability attaches to everybody who's running a node or is mining Bitcoin.
Yeah, that makes sense. Could you imagine having to be a public miner explaining this to the judge and explain to them how, like, the mechanics of all of this and why they're not guilty? I mean, and maybe you had some experience.
They've had to explain more complicated things to judges. I mean, it's not... Like, I think, the beauty of our legal system here in the United States is that a lot of the clerks that work for the judges are very young. They're fresh college graduates in many cases. Law school graduates. And so they're younger than we are. And they are obviously, you know, more tech savvy than older generations. And they're the ones that the judge is really relying on to you know, make a good judgment. And so we saw this as Bitcoin miners in Waco, Texas, when we sued the federal government because the federal government was trying to dox our electricity providers. And, you know, the judge's rulings and the interactions in the courthouse, I felt like they displayed no shortage of understanding of the truth in the matter. You know, I think that I'm not really worried about that, but it obviously that comes with real litigation costs, right? Like, you still have to hire attorneys you still have to fight it, right? I think that as Bitcoiners, it's very easy to fall into the trap of, let's say, like, you've got 5-year-old children playing soccer against, a FIFA, you know, national team, right? And you know who's going to win, right? You know the FIFA team's going to win against these 5-year-old kids, but the FIFA team still has to play, right? Yeah. And I think that, like, some Bitcoiners are like, oh, we'll just sit on the bench and, like, there's, you know, we're obviously going to win because we're the FIFA team and they're the 5-year-old kids. And then, like, the 5-year-old kids are scoring goals on them because it's just, you know, you got to get out on the field and you got to actually put in some amount of work. And so that's where I think that what we're going to see is that as Bitcoin treasury companies and as Bitcoin miners have more and more ability to influence policymaking in Washington, D.C., it really mitigates a lot of these regulatory risks of, well, what happens if a criminal uses the blockchain in this way or that way? Because obviously, you know, if somebody finances a terrorist attack that's catastrophic, you know, a nuclear weapon detonates in New York City and they prove that it was purchased with Bitcoin, you know, that would be a challenging moment for the community, just as much as any other kinds of scenarios that we can cook up in our imaginations.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. All right, so back to Knott's Core. So I've seen you kind of bat back and forth with Luke Desch Jr., and I would be curious to hear what your specific complaint, and I think I'd probably share at least one sentiment with you, but just in maybe more broadly, what is your issue with the way that it's either being framed, communicated, or perhaps even the technical solution that Knott's proposes to address?
I think that Luke is overselling the effect of Knott's over what's going to happen, that it's kind of setting up people for disappointment of, oh, I'm running Knott's. Like, why are we not keeping all this out of the blocks? And, oh, they're just ratting around us and kind of, you know, demoralizing or further radicalizing them in a direction that's not productive, rather than being transparent and honest with people, which is that, hey, this is a really imperfect solution. It's not the end of Bitcoin when there is spam on the Bitcoin blockchain. But that we have to keep pushing in this direction of doing everything in our power to mitigate scams and spam. Really, you know, the argument that should be made, I think, is the economic argument, which is that this spam is making running a Bitcoin node more expensive, and it's making sending a Bitcoin transaction more expensive. And that is against the user's interests. You know, it's really incumbent on us to do everything we can, including a soft fork, in order to, you know, go in the right direction. Now, I also think that Knott's comes bundled with a bunch of other changes, okay? I was doing a comparison, you know, line by line of the different changes that Knott's doesn't make to the Bitcoin code base compared to Core. And that's fine. Everybody's entitled to, you know, it's open source. They can run their own project and all of this. But to kind of go out there and promote an implementation using inflammatory rhetoric and exaggerating the impact of that implementation on the problem that is being described, and kind of downplaying the risks of running an implementation that frankly just has less code review than Bitcoin Core, doesn't sit well with me.
Mm-hmm. So, by the way, on that topic, are there other attributes of knots that you noticed or identified that are materially different from Core that you would say, I think knots users should be aware of this, they might not want it? Or is it more trivial stuff that probably a filters proponent would appreciate about knots?
Yeah, I mean, it's very much focused on configurability, and I don't have anything against the changes. What I have against is thinking through maybe unintended side effects, right? And so that's where I think that from a software engineering perspective, you do need different sets of eyeballs on changes that are thinking through different angles to anticipate what, you know, as a layperson, you know, I'm not a C++ wizard by any means. I can read C++, but to think adversarially about C++ is a specialized, a skill set. And one that, frankly, is very concentrated in the Bitcoin Core project. And so I think that's, you know, it's not like there's a specific change that I'd point to and say, this is going to cause problems. It's more that, you want to be thinking about the governance of the project. And there's plenty to criticize on the Bitcoin Core side with regards to governance. I won't take that away from the knots proponents. But to go from, hey, look, you know, they don't communicate very well over at Bitcoin Core, and therefore I'm going to go use knots. I think maybe at the very least use both. But the problem with using both, which is what Luke Dasher pushed back on, he needs 100% market share. Okay, if everyone uses both, he only has 50% market share.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there? So the other thing I look at. The folks, so first of all, I'll concede with you on the knots side. I'm unconvinced that Core 30 ends everything. And to your earlier point, I think even if it did lead to some dire consequence, I still think disaster can be mitigated. My frustration as I look at the Core side is I see what, without having dug really deep on this, I see what appear to me to potentially be conflicts of interest. I see people who I would, and I hate to, be this Puritan, I'll take the toxic Bitcoiner claim, but this Puritan type, I see people who I associate with scams, or they're scam adjacent at least. And, the fact that they are so heavily pushing this change makes me wary of what the negative externalities of Core 30 could be. So on the opposite side of the coin, is there any validity to my concern, am I reading deeper into it?
So the concern I have with the changing the default is that we've never seen 100,000 byte op return, to my knowledge. Someone can correct me on that. And so it's like, well, what if that just on its own like causes a problem where some path of the code chokes up because that path has never been exercised before, or some combination of things causes a problem, which by definition is unforeseeable, right? Things that I can't even describe what it would be. Otherwise, I would go fix it right now, right? And so I do think that it's a serious risk. The process by which this change came about, to your point, also raises eyebrows. And that I think that what hurts the most in all of this is that this is like less than 1% of the Bitcoin code base, right? The Bitcoin Core code base is this change. It's just, some lines of code, a handful, compared to many other lines of code that have much more complexity, get much more day-to-day attention from the developers, right? This kind of mempool policy configuration is kind of, when you compare it to the project to add mempool clustering, this is just, it's a huge distraction in terms of kind of the overall engineering of the project and it's highly political. And so I would argue that some level of prudential judgment on the part of core developers would look at a pull request that messes with mempool policy and ask themselves, like, okay, we can see some marginal benefits that I was talking about earlier, you know, lower latency, better fee estimation, but this is a political hot potato and we're not touching it. And the marginal benefits are not worth us touching it at this time or for the foreseeable future. We'll just leave this pull request open here and go work on things that are not bike shedding, things that actually matter to improving the fundamental quality of the software. That, I think, requires having layers of management, which does not exist in the open source world, and also comes with its own costs. Right. So if you're developing software at a company, you have product managers that are involved with the business people, with the design teams, the marketing people, the advertising, the CLs, right? All these other constituencies, and they're kind of navigating corporate politics. And the best ones do it on behalf of the engineering team and on behalf of the users, and kind of try to balance those two things. And it's very hard. And so even the best product managers make mistakes. And you could argue that having a product manager involved in an open source project might have more costs than it has benefits. One of the benefits would be avoiding this kind of, acrimony between the user base and the engineers that has developed over the past years.
So you're hitting on maybe another aspect of my disillusionment with core, and that is the means of governance, I guess you could maybe summarize it. And I'm curious, I think you've been in Bitcoin about a decade, maybe a little bit longer than a decade, more than I have. So you've seen many iterations, new versions of core. You've seen hard forks, you've seen soft forks. And by the way, I guess maybe my direct question is what you just described what they should have done? Like, you believe that they made a mistake touching this hot potato as they did, or you're just saying hypothetically that's something they could have considered, or you think
I think they made a mistake. I think they did. Everybody makes mistakes. Like, so I would combine that with, we've never had a better Bitcoin Core developer community and team and set of contributors. And so those two statements can be true at the same time.
In terms of talent, breadth, what do you mean by
that? All the above. And so I think that, the code base, broadly speaking, is in better shape than it's ever been. And I'd only point to like two lines of code of like, disagree with that of data carrier size default or its existence at all, but that would require adding some code to do a soft fork. But all that to say that you can have two thoughts at the same time of this was not handled correctly, this was a mistake, and there's not really any better alternative. I don't think the governance over Knots is inherently better than the governance over Bitcoin Core. Luke Dasher is not immune from making mistakes as well. He too is a mere mortal like us. And so I think that it's kind of, we just have to stay humble from a software engineering perspective that Bitcoin Core contributors, first of all, it's a constantly changing set in the sense that like, who was it 10 years ago is different than who it is today. And past generations of Bitcoin Core contributors have gone by the wayside, and they're contemporaries. So like, if you look at, Gavin Andreessen and Jeff Garzik are no longer Bitcoin Core contributors. They were contributors at the same time as Luke Dasher and Peter Woolley, and who both are still Bitcoin Core contributors, right? And so there will be turnover. There will also be continuity. There'll be new faces. But I think to say like, oh, I'm disillusioned with Bitcoin Core, and so like I don't like them anymore, is kind of just group punishment over a mistake that arguably is more of an optics mistake than a technical mistake. We'll see about that, right? Depending on what happens. I think that both sides are right, of the users being frustrated with Bitcoin Core and the Bitcoin Core developers kind of having what they're optimizing for blind them from kind of the pushback on the user side.
To what extent then, see, you agree that it was a mistake to proceed with this. To what extent, because what I'm trying, the only two variables I can wrap my head around that might affect should they have proceeded is sentiment. I think the fact that people are migrating to knots over this change, yeah, or appear to be, and it seems to be organic. I'm sure there are some people spinning up multiple nodes and that sort of thing, but in general, Knot seems to be gaining a lot of ground. And then like the sentiment online, which I would point to X specifically, obviously that's not indicative of all users everywhere across the globe, but it's not nothing. It's, you know, it's something to point to. Like how should they go about seeking some level of consensus, and what level of consensus should they be seeking in order to make a change like this that might potentially be contentious?
Yeah, so I think their only criteria in this is technical correctness. Is this the correct
precedent? Is that precedent? Is like historically, is that precedent technical correctness, or is that what they've just chosen to use as their barometer this time?
I think that that's what they're aiming for, but that's what I would argue they've always aimed for. The problem is that the inputs to that technical correctness change over time, right? So we inherently learn more about the world. From their perspective, they've learned that the limit on op return is useless because of taproot inscriptions, right? And that even, let's say taproot inscriptions had not happened, if it was just SegWit inscriptions that had gone viral, you know, with the introduction of ordinals, I think that they would have come to that same conclusion. So I don't think that Taproot was necessarily a mistake either. You could also go further and argue that even without the witness discount, the spammers would have still used SegWit inputs to add inscriptions. And so this is where I'd start disagreeing with the Bitcoin Core people is on the marginal cost of spam. I think that every time you make it cheaper to spam, you get more spam, right? In terms of technical correctness, I don't think that there's like I think that's what they are continuing to pursue in good faith. I think that what they have to start to include as well, there's a parallel with the Supreme Court. So if the Supreme Court looked at cases purely from technical correctness perspective, they would not factor in reversal of precedent, right? So but they do that, and they call it stare decisis, basically. Yeah. Like, if we ruled this in the past, there's actually a higher bar than technical correctness. There's like, oh, there needs to be like a really strong reason for us to undo this precedent. And you could argue the same thing in Bitcoin Core that I think is underappreciated by the core developers for the most part. They'd obviously have counter arguments to that. I would also make that same argument to the maintainers of knots. Okay. So
yeah, it applies broadly.
Yeah.
No, I think you're hitting on an interesting point there, because I think the reason I would value precedence is because part of the value prop of Bitcoin is largely, you know, when you buy Bitcoin, when you exchange fiat for Bitcoin, you are not just alternating out of one asset into another, but you are also putting, like, you're voting with your wealth into something that you think is relatively unchanging.
Yeah,
you understand now, it's going to be a maintenance and all of right. that, but and now we've got billions in ETFs who people bought. Now, I'm not suggesting that the people buying ETFs generally understand what's going on here and that what we're talking about.
It could potentially impact their financial prospects. But
exactly.
Look, I think that the core counter argument to what I just stated about their change on op return is, well, in which way do you want to go? Do you want to bring consensus rules closer to mempool policy, which is a bigger break in precedent, right? To say we're going to not only, because I want to soft fork out op returns, but I also want to soft fork in a limit on the size of inputs to maximize the cost of spam without impacting monetary transactions, because that I think is the right thing to do. And I think it's the technically correct thing to do. But it is a much greater upheaval of precedent than going in the opposite direction of changing mempool policy, because mempool policy is much more flexible than consensus policy. And then we have to ask the question of, are they correct in wanting to converge those two sets of consensus rules and mempool policy? I could argue that they are correct in the long term, but they are doing so far too prematurely. And that you would really want to see a lot more activity of people sending transactions directly to miners and not using the public relay network to then come to the conclusion that you need to do something to improve the public relay network.
Yeah. That's sort of how I feel. It feels like a patch for a problem that hasn't really quite manifested.
But here's the problem, again, in the other direction. The public relay network is kind of a public good. And you could imagine a world where nobody runs a public mempool and all transactions are submitted to miners directly. And you don't know anything about price of the next block. It's all privately negotiated behind closed doors, which I think is what Bob Burnett from Ocean wants. And that you also have no permissionless way of submitting transactions and publicly broadcasting them to attract new hash rate that does not exist. And so I think that there's a real strong argument for node operators that we want the public relay network. We want to maximize its value for Bitcoin miners so that we minimize the development of private relay. Because if private relay takes hold, and we might never get public relay back.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there is one sort of, well, actually, no. Let me take a step back real quick. I want to ask you a question about censorship, because that's part of the debate. Everyone's throwing around the word censorship, and then the filters folks argue that we've always had filters. We don't care what you spend your Bitcoin on. We care that it's a monetary network. It's not a network full of spam and JPEGs. Do you buy it? We haven't talked about censorship since in the last hour. I'm curious. Do you find what Knots does to be censorship, or do you feel like it's just we have different thresholds for which we're willing to fight for a monetary network versus a network full of spam?
We have talked about censorship, right? So when I was talking about the OFAC transactions,
I guess that's right.
Yeah, no, maybe I didn't use that word. But
No, you're right.
I also think that
the dialogue on X, though, of you want to censor my transaction and it's none of your business what that transaction.
I've intentionally not used that word because I don't think it's censorship in any direction. Okay. And so when a mining pool decides not to include a transaction, as long as they're doing it voluntarily, then it's not censorship. If the government is forcing them to do that, then the government is censoring that mining pool. But they're not censoring the Bitcoin network if the government doesn't have the ability to prevent another mining pool from including that transaction and from other mining pools from building on top of that block. And so the idea, like, I would argue that the Bitcoin network is censorship resistant. Individual participants on the network are not at all, right? That's why that's the value of being decentralized, right? If individuals were censorship resistant on their own, then what would be the value of Bitcoin at all, right? Or of decentralization? It wouldn't have any value, right? So it's a really interesting paradox where the censorship resistance is kind of the sum of the nodes, the sum of the miners. It's the permissionless nature of the network, right? It's an open network. So I don't think individual participants can do anything that I would describe as censorship. If the U.S. government said, hey, look, like, globally speaking, nobody in the world is allowed to mine these Bitcoin transactions, and we will, you know, drone strike your mining facility if you do that, and that transaction, it's stuck in the mempool because no mining pool will include it in a block, that transaction, after, let's say, 100 blocks, is being censored, right? And really, you know, we've reached a point where Bitcoin has severely degraded in its censorship resistance that we're not even able to attract new hash rate to get that mining fee paid to them.
And then the exception. So in general, I think I agree with you. I might summarize it as it's one thing if a centralized entity chooses to block certain types of transactions. To me, that's censorship. You call it the government. But if individuals choose using their own hardware and network and, you know, resources to not relay certain transactions, it's not censorship. The one, I guess the one place I might sympathize a little bit with, there's a band of the core camp that are like the hardcore privacy advocates who, my understanding, I don't really get the mechanism by which this happens, but they view it as censorship that their coin joins or certain privacy oriented transactions might be filtered out through knots. And so many of them are like blocking knots nodes from what I understand. Do you know much about that? Or is that something you could speak to?
Well, I mean, they are free to peer with other nodes to avoid that problem. But I don't think that's censorship. I mean, the knots people could say, hey, you're censoring the knots nodes, right? It's like, where does it end? It's just a loaded term. As long as it's voluntary activity, I don't see a problem with it, because, you know, the big blockers, they would say that, oh, you're censoring big blocks, right? You're rejecting them. It's like, well, look, like, everybody here is voluntarily doing that. The government didn't force us to make that decision. And so part of decentralization is self-sovereignty, but also that you're not the sovereign over others. And so you kind of have to, on some level, accept other people are going to do what they can do within the constraints of the system.
It's like natural law playing out in the digital realm.
Yeah.
So, Pierre, I guess my last question, and you sort of answered this, I think, if you had full control of the code and everyone had to run your implementation, is the answer you would soft fork, you would address the spam issue, sort of more of a root cause level, remove op return entirely? Is that sort of the approach that you would take?
I mean, I could go further and say, like, I'd make sure that the standardness rules for, you know, monetary transactions are consensus rules and not just mempool policy. That would mean that I would need to continue to be in control, though, because when there's improved monetary scripting technology that becomes available and that we need to add that to Bitcoin, that, because of the soft forks, that could need to be a hard fork. And this is kind of the challenge for the Bitcoin Core developers is, do you cut off future things by doing things today to cut off spam? And that they have to be long-term stewards of the protocol and kind of try to maintain the options on the table to be able to address things like quantum, right? Like, that's not FUD, okay? Like, there, you know, quantum computing is something that will have to be worked on over the coming years and decades. But there's going to be other challenges as well. And there's very strong trade-offs if we're decentralized. If it's Pierre's world where I make all the decisions, we will be able to fix quantum very easily. Okay. So, you know, it's like with a hard fork, because I can do a hard fork because I'm the only one in charge.
Yeah. That's the funny thing is, I think that the best solution might be a hard fork where we just remove any opportunity for spam to ever touch the blockchain. But you need such, we're at a place, to my earlier point about, we've got a zillion people who own ETFs who are dependent on Bitcoin as is to a large extent. You have to sort of honor the fact that people are in Bitcoin in various ways. Okay, so come October, whatever it is, I don't know the date. Are you running Core 30 or are you sticking to 29? You running knots? What are you thinking?
So I run a patch set over Core. I don't even know which version because I haven't rebased recently for my analytics node. What I will do is rebase onto version 30 and set data carrier size to zero. I mean, I feel like that's the one part I disagree with the Core developers on, and I can go fix that. If they remove the configuration, then I will add to my patch set the configuration back to keep it, and I'll just keep rebasing off of future Bitcoin Core versions.
Okay, beautiful. Okay, last question for you. If you could go a different direction than Knots versus Core, I'd love it. But what's an unpopular opinion that you have? You get bonus points if you offend some Bitcoiners with it.
I think this is the most unpopular opinion, is that Bitcoin treasury companies can, over the long run, financially outperform spot Bitcoin. And I think that it's unpopular because we want to believe that doing the right thing is ultimately the most profitable thing. And that if there's, and that if doing the right thing is self-custody, then that kind of takes off the table investing in a Bitcoin treasury company. And so it should necessarily be the case that these treasury companies are going to financially underperform Bitcoin, spot Bitcoin. But because of the leverage that they have access to and the terms they have it on, I think that that's where that kind of breaks down. And so that means that you have to then do a calculation of, okay, I think long-term Bitcoin treasury companies are going to outperform spot Bitcoin, but at the cost of, I don't control my own money and I'm sacrificing self-sovereignty in order to increase financial return. And what is my trade-off from a, you know, subjective preference perspective between my own self-sovereignty and how I want to self-custody my Bitcoin versus the opportunity of outperforming it with leverage and the risk of trusting a third party to custody the asset and to manage the whole structure and all of that. And so that's where, you know, I think that obviously in the end, that's just going to be different for different folks. But being clear-eyed about the fact that spot Bitcoin being the benchmark is great. It also means that there's a lot of people that are motivated to try to outperform that. And the way, I think the only reasonable way to do that is with some amount of leverage that avoids the liquidation risk along the way. But also mechanically does financially outperform Bitcoin.
Interesting. Yeah, the way I've sort of seen it, because I view treasury, like I'm generally disinterested because I'm not an investor. Like I'm a saver, and like I don't understand the mechanics enough, as I'm sure you do. The way I've sort of maybe come to appreciate it is, first of all, there are untapped pools of capital, I think, that just don't have the option of or self-sovereignty interests of, you know, spot Bitcoin. But also you do have people who say, maybe I want to save 80% of my money in Bitcoin, but then I want to see if I can outperform. And I understand it's either speculative or it's a longer time horizon that I might have to wait or what have you. So while I like, it's not something I personally get excited about, I understand that you've got professional investors and people who do understand the mechanics who, you know, might have an interest in that. So, awesome, Pierre. Well, hey, in the interest of your time, why don't you just tell people where they can find you? Thank you again so much for coming on. This has been a blast.
On X at Bitcoin Pierre. Thanks for having me on.
Of course, Pierre. Good talking. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cheers. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Pierre. Do me a favor, leave a comment. Tell me what you think about this discussion, if it changed your mind on anything. I think this was absolutely fascinating. Go follow him on X as well. Of course, if you're enjoying the show, leave a comment, like, subscribe, share this with a friend. We would really appreciate anything to help feed the algorithm, of course. And if you need help taking your Bitcoin into proper 100% self-custody, go to thebitcoinway.com/podcast, schedule a free 30-minute consult with a member of our team. We can also help you with online privacy, setting up a privacy phone. We have an awesome Plan B residency in Panama that is getting incredibly popular as tyrannical rulers all over the world make terrible, terrible choices for their citizens. We can help you spin up a BitAx, all sorts of cool things. Again, thebitcoinway.com/podcast. We hope to hear from you soon. Until next time, stay safe, stay sovereign, and remember, the yield on Bitcoin is freedom.